Innovation Rockstars. Innovation Rockstars.
Today with Gabriella Rizzo, Research Director of the Swiss Center for Positive Futures at the University of Lausanne. As early as the age of 8, Gabriella Rizzo knew that he wanted to become a physicist one day. In this episode, things get almost a little philosophical. Gabriella introduces us to the Swiss Center for Positive Futures and explains what exactly lies behind the idea of positive futures and what role the theme of hope plays as a driving force in this thought model. We also take a look at Gabriella's latest book, HR Futures 2030, a futurist guide to the challenges and changes in the world of work, backed up by evidence-based trends and signals, offering pragmatic upskilling pathways. If you want to learn more about positive futures or how to maintain the importance of humans in a future that will be even more machine-driven, this is your episode.
Now on Innovation Rockstars.
Hi, and welcome back to Innovation Rockstars. My name is Chris Mühlroth, and in this episode, I am excited to welcome Gabriella Rizzo. Gabriele did his PhD in string theory and astrophysics, and he founded the Swiss Center for Positive Futures, the new research institute and summit of futures thinking at the University of Lausanne, where he serves as its director of research. He is also the UNESCO chair candidate for positive futures, futures literacy and anticipation, futures advisor to the chief scientist to the United States Space Force and United States Air Force, member at large, strategic foresight and future studies at NATO, national lead on futures thinking at the General Office for Defense Innovation at the Italian Ministry of Defense, and a former ministerial advisor for futures to the Italian Minister of Defense. Now, that's a lot, Gabriele. I hope I got all of this right. Thank you so much for joining us. I am excited to have you on the show.
Chris, it's great to be here with you. You got it all 100% right.
Perfect. Awesome. So we start straight away with a short 60 seconds introduction sprint. It's all about you and your professional career. So for the next 60 seconds, the stage is all yours. Let's go.
Thanks, Chris. Well, I was a kid fascinated by how nature works and what nature hides. When I was 8, reading an article on Scientific American about black holes and how crossing the event horizon is a non-event, I decided I had to become a physicist. And that bliss, that awe, is dear to me. I can't help it. I am fascinated by imagination, by people and their creativity. I didn't know back then, but that inspiration was the key for me to become a futurist. Because in the future, everything can be possible. You create your own limits and unleash the power of imagination, alone, in a small group, or in a large group. You turn boundaries into limits. A boundary is what prevents wielding the power of act. Limits are the intrinsic condition for the production of new possibles. Because for something to be possible, it can be possible anything. If anything is possible, nothing is real.
All right, Gabriele, so next, here are three sentence starters for you, and I would like to ask you to complete them. Let's start with number one. Being a futures advisor means?
Providing a seamless transition from near to far with incredible sharpness so that leaders can see no limits in their opportunities. If I can have another sentence here, I'd say that there's a whole lot more to being a futures advisor, and one of the things being that most of times whenever you try to advise people in thinking 20 years out or 40 years out, people think that every decision accumulates at the further hand of the time horizon, and that's simply not true. But we'll talk about this later on.
Absolutely. Let's talk about this later on. And then number two, one of the most important things I learned from my doctorate in the fields of string theory and astrophysics is
thinking in terms of organizing principles. Physics, as a model of reality, as a model of nature, helps you in thinking with fundamental principles. And that's extremely helpful. It's probably the most precious compass you can have when it comes to navigating complexity.
It probably is. Thank you. And finally, number three, if I could give you exactly one book recommendation, it would be this.
I'm stealing your single book recommendation and making this multiple. So if there's a casual reader that's interested about the future, I'd recommend Future Shock by Alvin Toffler. That's a masterpiece written in the 70s, and it's so very compelling even today. If you're learning about futures, I'd suggest Thinking About the Future by Andy Hines and Peter Bishop. And I could also suggest my book, HR Futures 2030. For the futures professional, definitely I would recommend Transforming the Future. That's edited by Real Miller. And I could also suggest my latest handbook of Foresight Strategy and Future Studies for Defense and Security.
Awesome. Thanks. I'll take all five of them. That's great. And Gabriele, it's really great to have, you know, such a visionary futurist and innovator here in the show today. So I got a lot of questions for you, but let's start with the basics. As I learned, you founded you are the director of research at the Swiss Center for Positive Futures. Now, the term positive futures sounds like a deliberately chosen expression to me. So can you maybe at first please explain how you define the term positive futures?
Chris, you're exactly right here. It was a deliberate choice because we're not seeing positive as in the opposite of negative. And it's not even positive as in just the fruit of experience. So it's about being all-encompassing. It's being able to involve all the aspect of a certain part that you're trying to study. And in this case, so it's about having the presence rather than the absence of distinguishing traits. So positive futures are all-encompassing, are constructive, and getting more in depth in the content are also about the highest hope we can try to have.
Got it. So it means all-encompassing, it means constructive. So does that mean that there is no negative futures? I suppose you get asked this question quite a lot, but just to confirm.
Absolutely. That's always the number one question I get. So, that's positive future. So what about the negative ones? And you're not looking at this in the right way. So it's positive, negative futures. You're attributing a judgment to it. Positive futures is about holding back judgment and trying to integrate all the parts in this, future orientation, this forward view that you're trying to build. It's about also reframing our narrative about the dark. The idea of positive futures is twofold. Is about, from one hand, changing the way we think about the dark and we use the dark. So changing the dark from a place that's filled up with monsters to a place that is a source of creativity and inspiration. And on the other hand, it's about preparing the preconditions for a step change in the long-term civilization direction of travel. So it's to do this, there's a whole lot of background. I'm sure we'll get into that later.
Got it. Okay. And aside from that question, so whether or not there is a negative futures, what is kind of the number one or then maybe number two question you get asked all the time on positive futures, and what is your answer to it?
Well, definitely the number one question is, what about the negative ones? And then it's, well, how do you do this? So how can you be so integrative, so all-encompassing and so high-hoping for this kind of perspective? And in this case, there's a whole structure to it, because the moment we're willing to create something that is so powerful and so driving for people, then to create such a massive change, a massive shift in the way we're interpreting civilization as a as an entire concept, there's something that can drive you. And in reframing the way we think about the dark, we understand that we can reframe the way we think about ourselves and hope. Hope is the single most important driver we can have when we are exploring uncharted waters of uncertainty, unknown, and complexity. What can we hope for? There's a whole branch of philosophy that's about hope and how can we attribute value to hope. And we follow Florida's approach to hope that attributes as a value to hope the value of the object of hope. So if you are into this approach, then the highest value you can have is the divine. So what we can do is hoping for the qualities of the divine. So we are able to impress this decisive and deliberate and groundbreaking change in our in the direction of travel of our entire civilization over the long term, the moment we are hoping, so we are aspiring to the qualities of the divine. And that is the way that our that's, you know, there's an entire field in the philosophy of theology about the qualities of the divine. But this, so they're also very practical because they're metaphors. So to understand how we can interpret these qualities into a technology-driven and pragmatic and actionable way, we are able to understand these directions as metaphors. So omnipresence, perfect knowledge, perfect goodness, and you know, all the others. These are three, for instance, just at the top of my head. We can interpret them as metaphors. Metaphors are a very important part of the methodologies and techniques we use within the Swiss Center for Positive Futures. So after that, we've got reframing the narrative about the dark. And the dark doesn't just have the outside part, that's hope. It has an inside part, that's our inner dimensions. So one of the other things that we do is understanding how our biases and resistances are driving us and are bounding our imagination and our creativity, so that we are able to unleash this power by using these biases and resistances, not anymore as boundaries, so something that's just avoiding, that's hampering, that's, you know, stonewalling the power to create. So from being boundaries to being limits, that's, you know, the lines and the field where to play. Without the lines and a field, you can't play. You don't know what games you're playing. But limits are what makes possible the to unleash the might of creativity. And that's something that we are, that's very dear to us in the way we're framing resistances and biases as compasses, as limits, not as boundaries.
So that's great. And let's now get, you know, directly to the Swiss Center for Positive Futures. As introduced earlier, you know, you founded it and you are the director of research there. So, you know, what you just described, basically, can I understand this to be the purpose and also the mission of that center?
That's a great question, Chris. And that also allows me to continue my sermon here, because once we have this whole vision about positive futures, as I said, how do we actually implement this? Well, it turns out that that is crucial in this, the human part, having the human at the core of strategies and designs that are willing to aspire to positive futures. And so what we do at the center is that we develop futures literacy for human sustainability towards positive futures.
Got it. Now, how do you do this exactly? I mean, there needs to be a founding story to that center, I guess, right? So I'd be really interesting to hear how come. Yeah, how did you, why, how, and sort of the how we clarify, but how did you do that? Why at Lausanne? That'd be really interesting to hear. And then also, I'd love to hear more about, you know, the actual implementations. But let's start with the founding story first. So how come? How did you start that? And how what's the story behind?
Oh, there's a wonderful story behind the founding of the Swiss Center for Positive Futures. And I'm very happy to share this with you and our audience today. It all started before COVID, and it seems ages ago. But before COVID, at Lausanne, there was a Future Skills Lab. So the very seed of futures thinking, very experimental, very ambitious, but, you know, very... very niche and, you know, just an avant-garde in a sense. So what happened is that the founder of the Future Skills Lab, Isabelle Chapuis, that's now my co-founder of the Swiss Center for Positive Futures, she was willing to start her journey through futures and foresight. But coming from directing the executive education department, so she's a longtime director. She founded the executive education department, brought that to impressive heights at the University of Lausanne, then pivoted to this other adventure. And she felt that futures were important in this, but she didn't quite have the grasp to work in futures. So she reached out to who is doing this in the best possible way, that is the defense world. And in the defense world, she reached out to the head of anticipation of the Swiss Armed Forces, that coincidentally is a friend of mine, because, I mean, it's a small crowd in the defense foresight. So she reached out to him and he reached out to me and we made the connection. What happened is that she wanted to do something about HR. And you can imagine that HR is not very enticing for this defense guy working in the classified world. But she was extremely well prepared and she delivered a great pitch. And the bottom line was, well, look, education is our first line of defense. And I'm like, that's President Truman. You did your homework. And so
she used that word. First line of defense.
Exactly. And that's how all the journey started.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. And on the topic of HR, actually, I you know, found that you, and I guess together with her, you published a book on HR futures. Its title is HR Futures 2030, if I'm not mistaken, exactly. A Design for Future Ready Human Resources. So, can you tell me what does future-ready HR look like?
That's a wonderful question. We can have a symposium on this. In just a few words, I'd say there's several things that we have discussed even before. First of all, future-ready human resources will have to be complex to be able to take advantage of the complexity of the environment. And by being organizational complex, then you're also able to be anti-fragile. So you are able to thrive under stress rather than breakdown. You're not just withstanding stress, that's being robust. You transition to be anti-fragile. Now, it's interesting to know that anti-fragility, as described by...
Was it Nassim Taleb? Not 100% sure.
Taleb, yes.
Yes, it was Taleb.
The idea is not that you are able to control antifragility. So antifragility is an emerging property. So to be antifragile, you have to give up control. Now, this is not something that most organizations would like to do. So that's the first point. If you need to give away the right measure of control so that your organization can perform better in stressing times. And there's another couple of points. One is that we actually used metaphors in our work. So in the book, there's an entire chapter about mythology. So we are using mythological figures as a means to grasp the disruptions that are incoming. Wittgenstein used to say that the limits of my language are the limits of my world. So to understand a new world, you need a new language. And how can we build this new language? By using the language we have in a way it's not supposed to be used. And that's what metaphors are. Metaphors are a way to use language in a way it's not supposed to be used. And in our work on mythology, we're looking at the human-machine continuum by pinpointing five places. And so we have demigods, centaurs, knights, minotaurs, and monks, depending on where you are in the human-machine continuums. Very important, there's not judgment in any of the five. All of the five are very important for the entire organization. You can't just have an organization that's just made up by demigods or just by centaurs. You need all the five figures. You need diversity, even in metaphors, even in complexity, even in your organization. And then we go through 22 new disciplines for human resources function that's ready for the 22nd century. And we look at several of the ways and means in which you can not just manage, but empower your capital. And so we have, for instance, aspirations and life design. So that's something you can offer to your workforce, not employees, but workforce. So designing their entire path, their entire career, not just within the organization, but looking, and not just in life, but looking at their entire span of life and their in life and online. So their on life presence. There's human autonomy teaming capital management, not just looking at humans and thinking of machines as part of your capital. There's something that no one was looking at when we wrote the book, because we wrote the book before Meta, you know, branded the metaverse. So we're looking at Mirror World, and we have employee branding and avatars as a function in the future ready human resources. So there's plenty of prompts and cues for thinking in the book, and it's very actionable.
It sounds like it is, and you can probably derive a lot of practical implications from that. And I guess this is tightly connected with something you touched on earlier in our conversation, which is human sustainability. So, and I guess there is many different aspects to that, but you know, one is that given that, at least right now, life expectancy, so the time you a human individual will actually be on Earth is rising. And I guess soon it will be no surprise anymore to see people getting, you know, 100 years and older as a new standard. How does this all connect? Yeah, you know, increased life lifespan for humans on Earth. Then you have certainly a longer period where you seem to be working in maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever organizations. Plus saying, well, you know, also touching human sustainability. So I guess this is, you know, kind of all addressing and pointing towards one of the ultimate goals, which might be human sustainability. But how does it connect in detail?
You really hit the nail on the head here. The idea is that, you know, human sustainability is about increasing the importance and relevance of human beings, regardless of the race, culture, and preferences of any kind. So is a more equitable, fair, and open way of growing as a civilization by putting humans at the center. So looking at human sustainability means understanding how can we maintain the relevance of humans in a future that's being even more disrupted by machines, right? So how can we? That's the point. Being able to anticipate these changes, and so being able to develop a workforce and talents that are fit for future is at the core of the work that we've done for HR Futures 2030. The idea is, for instance, when you look at human predictive maintenance, the idea is being able to have an evolution of what Stanford calls skill prints. So the idea in the 2025 vision of Stanford is having like these fingerprints, but for skills. How we see this, however, is not that you don't have just pictures of your skills, because your skills evolve with time. And the way you're able to capture a possible abilities you have, look at me, I had a PhD in string theory and astrophysics, but I am a futurist. So the way you connect these things is across time. Now, to do this, it's very important to have this vision of, you know, skills evolving with time. And how we do this is using what we call a skills DNA or a sculpture. So a sculpture, but with skills, so that we're able to have this three-dimensional spatio-temporal representation of skills for a single profile. So we're able to capture these cross correlations. If we're able to seize this, then we're also able to develop and deliver a much more meaningful strategies for human sustainability.
Okay, I understood. That sounds brilliant. Now, let's turn our focus maybe to, you know, some recent project. Obviously, you can talk about nothing confidential or so. Where you actually applied, you know, these principles and these approaches for the better. Can you share some, you know, examples, cooperations, might be industry cooperations with private or even public companies, doesn't really matter. And how do you approach that? What approaches did you use? And how much out into the future did you actually look at? Was it 10 years, 20 years, 50, 100 in that project?
So we have several projects that are currently ongoing. One of them is with the Swiss Armed Forces, and it's called Tech Plus. Because when you look at technology foresight, it's not just tech, it's plus. So Tech Plus looks at what we call technology spectrum, what NATO calls technology spectrum. So we're, as we Center for Positive Futures, we're also part of several NATO research task groups. I am in several of them. One of them is about how can technology change the way we look at the future operating environment, how technology developments can impact the future operating environment. Now, it's a nice trivia is that this group was once called TechRocks with an entire acronym. But I mean, the idea is that looking at a technology, you need to understand what's at the core of technology. What's the ontological existence of technology when it comes to understanding how the nature of technology will evolve over time in a time of exponential progress. And the nature of technology is that it's something that lets us interact with nature. So to understand how technology evolves or can evolve, what are the possible or impossible developments of technology, because the impossible are much more fun than the other, you have to look at how you can understand nature. And there's this technology spectrum that's about space, time, perception, cognition, and choice is one of the ways we are looking at pushing the envelope of future status by looking at, you know, radical notions today. How far do we look? Well, that's an interesting question. By definition, nothing that's less than 10 years is foresight. So if you're doing foresight, the least you can do is 10 years. So it can be a matter of conversation when you hear industry saying that their strategic horizon is 5 years or 3 years. I would argue that in that case, what you're doing is not a strategy, you're executing the present. So how far then? How can you pick 10, 20, 35, 52? Well, there's research on the fact that the time you need to field an entirely new capability is 20 years. So from the moment you think of having a big red button on your desk to the moment you can have the big red button on your desk, having lots of hell that can be unleashed, it takes 20 years. So a capability development wave, as it's called, is a 20 years time span. So either you look at multiples of 20, or you can look at infrastructure development waves. There's research showing that infrastructure develops over waves of multiple of 55 years. That's the time span of a Kondratiev wave. So if you look at the development of railway, for instance, over the territory of the United States, that took 110 years. The infrastructure for air travel took 55 years to develop. Then, so either it's multiple of 20 or it's multiple of 55. There's also research showing that you can look at third harmonics of Kondratiev waves. So looking at time spans of 17 years, and that still makes sense when it comes to economic cycles. So here's how we look at things. So what you usually do is either looking at multiple of 20s or looking at multiple of 55.
Understood. On the Kondratiev waves, isn't that, you know, true that, you know, the cycles of the Kondratiev waves actually, you know, getting shorter over time? I mean, yes, 55 years might be our assumption for now, but given technological progress and maybe even exponential acceleration, does that still hold true in the future that you're trying to project?
Chris, I love this question. Because it gets to a halfway explanation of why Kondratiev waves will still be 55 years. Because it's true that we do have exponential acceleration of technology. And in this sense, what we are able to achieve compresses exponentially. It's also true, however, that the intensity of the wave increases exponentially. So what we are able to achieve with one infrastructure wave is not what we're able to do, what we were able to do with the previous infrastructure wave. I'll give you an example. There's a whole lot of discussing about using modeling and simulation for design and to accelerate the 20 years capability waves. Now, and people show how they're able to reproduce previous developments in like 5 years. And that's the entire point. So you're able to use the next wave technology to compress the previous wave. And that's perfectly fine. But the point is, where is it that you're able to land by using that 20-year technology to develop that wave, that exact same wave technology? So you're able to, so what I'm saying is the wave, the time is fixed. It's the intensity that increases exponentially. So we will still have infrastructure wave and capability waves that long, but what we'll be able to achieve at the very end is exponentially more.
It is a lot more and exponentially more. Okay, got it. That makes sense, I guess. That's cool. Now, what I would be also interested to hear is, can you talk about some of the methodologies you are applying, maybe in that project with the Swiss Armed Forces? Is it a rather qualitative? Is it a rather quantitative approach? Is there some, you know, mixing between qualitative and quantitative data? So how do you typically tackle this with which methodologies?
When we have a very, very broad toolbox, so I'm coming with more than a couple of hundred techniques and methodologies from the defense world and that world, right? The idea, though, is that we're able to tailor a single pipeline for each of the issues we have. So there's not a single methodology that we're using every time. Because otherwise, you're back into the example of of someone going around with a hammer and anything that they see is a nail. And that's, you can do that. You can do that in defense, because in defense, if there's something failing, people die usually. So you have to be extremely careful in how you're tackling problems when you're giving them in the defense world. So I'm bringing this attitude and this posture in what I do with governments and education, academia, and business. So I'm looking at problems in the broadest way I can, so that we're able to deliver something that is specific to that problem. Now, most of issues in foresight, it goes through doing brainstorming, doing a lot of literature review, doing signals and storing signals, understanding signals. What we do is, of course, as we are part of the Association of Professional Futurists, we latch onto the foresight competency model. So we go through the 6-step competency model, and we, you know, so that we're able to deliver the exact things at the exact place. So designing, sync, scanning, futuring, visioning, and, you know, and then the final part of delivering. So is it qualitative or quantitative? There's no better fact about the future. First Dator's law. So it can be quantitative. It is qualitative, always. Can it be quantitative? To a point. You can imagine having, if you're doing something that's very in-depth, you can imagine starting creating, you know, key performance indicators in, for instance, a portfolio of scenarios. If you do scenario planning, you don't just a notice for those who are not very familiar with scenario planning, you don't just do one scenario, make one scenario, and then you plan. Scenario planning is about delivering a portfolio of scenarios that are around some dimensions. So it's not just, okay, we do 4 or 5 because that's all we were able to think about. You decide several dimensions, and then you explore how your ability to create worlds that respond to these knobs being turned. If you do this very much in depth, then you're also able to look for quantitative indicators within each of the scenarios, and then be able to look across scenarios to understand the impact. And that can be sort of quantitative, because then if you're looking across 64 scenarios, for instance, then you're able to, and you're able to assess the impact of several factors across them, then you do have some metrics on the perceived importance of some factors across this range of scenarios.
So like a cross impact matrix, for example, and other techniques that typically can be used. But of course, they rely on human judgment, don't they? Yes.
They do.
All right, Gabriele, I could listen to you for many more hours. We have come really far in this episode already. It's just about time to wrap it up. But before we do that, two more questions that I totally need your answer on them. So number one is, since I have you here, let's take a look into the crystal ball, the far out crystal ball. Could be 1, 2, 3, or however, you know, how much decades you want to look for out for in the future. What can we expect? What's on the broader horizon?
That's a great question. Well, I'll pick it up from one of my latest keynotes. So I'd say that 100 years from now, we will be able to, we would have been able to crack faster than light travel. So, because there are significant signals today. And by being able to travel faster than light, the astronomical trajectory of our civilization will open up to a way we are unable to grasp as of today. Also, because I let my being a trekker, across in this last part of the answer. It is also plausible that, you know, this eerie silence that is across universe, it seems there's no one here, is also a signal that we're too far behind with respect to the entire universe level of development. So going faster than light, that's, understanding how serious Mother Nature is about the speed of light and seems that she's not that serious, we will be able to give the entire civilization on Earth and in the solar system something radically different to play with.
That is beautiful, and indeed that would be a radical thing humanity would look out for. Okay, and finally, you know, I need to ask you the signature rockstar question, right? So when you look back on your professional career, Gabriele, what would you say, if you had to pick one, what was your, you know, most impactful innovation rockstar moment so far, at least?
So I was in a location in Colorado, I was with the chief scientist of the Space Force, and we were running a workshop on space futures. That was in November 2019. And we were running this workshop. So there were tens of people around the room with sticky notes all over the place. The entire room was packed, and you know, you could feel the buzz in the air of something great happening. And so he calls me and he goes like, you know, by walking me across the room, and he says, well, look, Michelangelo had stone, Leonardo had inventions, and you've got Post-its. You're the Michelangelo of Post-its.
Beautiful, the Michelangelo of Post-its, that's brilliant. And that sounds like a great rockstar moment, Gabriele. Awesome. And with that, we wrap up this episode with the Michelangelo of Post-its. Thank you a lot for taking the time and being part of Innovation Rockstars.
A great pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me.
And to everybody listening or watching, if you like the show, then leave us a rating or a review and share the podcast with friends and colleagues. And if you want to get in touch, simply shoot us a message at info@innovationrockstars.show. Now that's it. Thanks for your time. See you and hear you in the next episode. Take care and bye-bye.
Innovation Rockstars.
This was Innovation Rockstar Gabriele Rizzo from the Swiss Center for Positive Futures at the University of Lausanne. If you want to dive deeper into the topic of positive futures or future-ready human resources, or if you'd simply like to give us feedback on this episode, feel free to email us at info@innovationrockstars.show. For more inspiring innovation stories, visit our website at www.innovationrockstars.show or browse through our Innovation Rockstars channel on all major podcast platforms. And while you are here, please leave us a rating for our show.